to come here. I told you I would embarrass you before you left. From Lincolnshire, Illinois. Yeah, there she is. It was just by chance that we happened to be here on the same day. And so, in the Japanese context, we have the 1780s. The Russians are applying major pressure for trade, and they want all kinds of things from Japan. The West is returning. And so 1785, the Sekisui takes the Ricci map, but it's the sort of Japanese 17th century deconstructed Ricci map. So again, it's pretty, nice colors. You still have this entire, none of that has changed. All of that has changed cartographically. All that information has been updated. And they're aware of it. But again, the idea is that the West is back. We pull from the past. And I don't think it was intentional that the Chinese, Japanese, and Koreans all did this at the same time. But they all did this at the same time. And it was all about identity, again, their place in the world, the larger world, no longer regional, the West is coming back. And so the map that hook is the West, Ricci, the world, all of those things are coming to a sort of critical mass. And so this map is produced and reproduced. This one happens to be from the 1850s. This is like the eighth production of this. It was produced small scale, big scale, but again, it's not all the information about all the places that we know about. It's the Ricci map. It's just the Ricci map, and it's this hook that's used for all of them. I'm gonna just take a drink. So this map got a little squashed as well. So I'm going to stop talking about Ricci and talk about ways that Western mapping actually does become integrated into East Asian mapping. So we know that Ricci comes in the 17th century, but historical maps, certainly visually in their construct and the kinds of information, doesn't change until the 19th century. And so in 1800, the Shogun... So we've had the Macartney mission has come. So this is the British East India Company and the British Crown sends George Macartney in 1793, goes to China first, meets with Qianlong, who says, see ya, goes to Japan. It's a little warmer reception, but I wouldn't call it cordial necessarily. Western, up-to-date Western maps, British-made maps, so the late second half of the 18th century, this is the period when in all of Europe, the British are making the best maps. Part of it is that Cook has just circumnavigated the world, and he has all this information, and all of this is compiled. The Shogun in 1800 says, okay, this is, and he goes to his astronomical bureau, and he says, I need a map of the world. I need Western technologies for triangulation, for creating an accurate Western, accurate style map. And so he hires two, Mamiya and Ino, to do these surveys. That takes them about 12 years. The map is plated in 1810. It's not actually printed until about 1816. But what you have is the first, and depending on your perspective, there's a lot of firsts about this. The other thing that's often discussed is why weren't, not only were East Asian maps accurate in terms of the information that's presented, but why aren't they more precise and finer? Because they're woodblock printed, because it's a technique that the East Asians have perfected, and they like it. It's cheap, easy, could do lots of copies. This map in Japan is the first map using copper plate. Copper plate's extremely expensive. You've got to create it on copper plates. It has to be etched, very time consuming. In terms of production, it's immensely more complicated and more expensive traditional woodblock printing. So this is the first copperplate produced map of the world in Japan. Some might consider it the most accurate world map at the time, produced anywhere, because it includes the information from the surveys done by Ino and Mamiya, which was not available to the rest of the world. And so for this little strip in here, we have information that's not available on any Western map, because this is the Sakhalin and the Kuril Islands that connect between Russia and the northern parts of Japan. No one had ever done surveys. So Westerners, there wasn't any reason for them to be there. The Russians who were there were mostly whalers, and they're certainly not interested in mapping accurately, going on land, and et cetera. So it's an extremely accurate map. The source material is East Asian and Western. So you have this wonderful long cartouche that all it says is Western. It says it provides you no information about the specific cartographic influence. However, so I don't know if you can make it out. So here, I neglected to point out to you that, and you can see, so a line like this is one of these lines. So this dotted line that you see, and I don't know if people in the front row can see, but this is covered in small dotted lines. And it tells you, almost everybody in here should be able to read what this says, but this essentially says Westerner Kuku, circumnavigation, and the year. It's a bit of a hint. So we happen to have in our collection, if you're interested, I wrote an article about this a couple of years ago. Aaron Arrowsmith, probably the most important cartographer from the 1790s to about 1820. He becomes the first royal geographer, first time it had been appointed. The Prince of Wales appoints him as that. Major producer of maps. And in 1790, he does this large format, multi-sheet, rectangular map that is a champion of all three of Captain Cook's circumnavigations. And so all of the information, these are all annotated. You see the same kinds of lines. And so right here is when he goes below the 70th parallel, which I mentioned earlier. But in addition, you have all of the important, certainly British, navigators who circumnavigated the world. It's a huge event that happens, and the British champion this, and Arrowsmith is the first to produce this beautifully colored large format map. So the other thing I'll mention is that's 1790. 1794, he does a simplified version. Double hemisphere, mass produced. This was produced for the court, and maybe 100 copies were done. This larger format in 1794 is done in sets of 500, and it gets reprinted 4 times over the course of 10 years. It's so immensely popular. So we have a map produced in 1794. And so there's no question that one of the major influences for the Takahashi map of the world produced in Japan is Arrowsmith's map. The issue is it the 1790? Is it the 1794? Because the 1790 has information that's on the Takahashi map, but the 1794 also has information that's only on the 1794 because some information has been updated between the four. And I think it's someone on the McCartney mission. There were 90 people who were sent from the British Crown, and I have no hesitation in saying that somebody gave the Chinese court and the Japanese court an Arrowsmith map. So we can actually more accurately date it. So for example, just so you can see where we're talking about. On the Arrowsmith map, we have two sandwich islands. The sandwich islands are what Cook called Hawaii. And then ultimately it was changed back to the Hawaiian name. So you have the North Sandwich Islands, and you have the South Sandwich Islands, which are down here off the coast of South America, just to give you some context. So we have those two, the same details. So this is the 1794 detail, this is the 1790 detail, and this is the Takahashi detail. And you notice that it says Sandu Ichirando. Sandwich land, because they hadn't actually gone all the way around them to know they were islands yet, and sandwich islands. And so between those two maps, 1790 and 1794, that information was updated, and so that's integrated into this map of the early 18th century. And so this is the kind of, this is what cartographers do. And it's because of the map library that I work at. We had the Takahashi map, I'm working on the Takahashi, and I have no idea, no one has thought about who that is. So I read, I'm looking in Japanese sources, and I'm reading, and it said something about Arrowsmith. I said, wait a second, we have the 1790 Arrowsmith map, we have the 1794 Arrowsmith map. I take the maps out, and I start literally with a magnifying lens, go back and forth, and I said, hey, wait a second, look at the differences. There are some very subtle, small things that change between the two, and so that helps us date which piece of information, which map was the actual source for Takahashi. And I digress just slightly. We offer at the Map Library a fellowship. It's a 3-week fellowship. It's open to anybody. Typically, it's academic, so they come in the summertime. Comes with a $3,500 stipend. We pay your way to get there. We have a guest house. It's a really nice gig. But one of the fellows who came this year is he's British born, but he lives in Japan, and he teaches in Kyushu University now. And he came because he gave a paper on the Takahashi map, and he said something about 1790, and I raised my hand afterwards, and I said, well, you know, actually 1794, sandwich land, this whole thing that I've just explained to you. He's kind of looking at me like, who are you? And afterwards he came up to me, he goes, you're Richard Pegg? And he said, you wrote that article in Orientations. I said, yes. And so I invited him to come. And so he's actually looked at some of the other sources, the Chinese sources, the Kangxi Atlas, some of that information. And he's specifically looking at the depiction of Southeast Asia and all of the islands that are based there, because it seems to be a combination of, as far as he knows, three different maps, including one French map. So there'll be more about this particular map. And I was able to sort of begin that. So we talked about this. So unique maps. What are characteristically unique maps? The Big Blue map, it's the only one like it. I don't know of any other culture where they created a map this big, this scale, 8 scrolls, originally 24 blocks, wood blocks, so each one is 3 blocks. It's enormous. It's, you know, it's 8 feet wide and 4 feet tall. What's really wonderful about this, and so one of my other fellows who came this summer, she's actually looking at East Asian depictions of Southeast Asia. She's a German born, she's just been teaching at University of Salzburg and is about to start at NYU Shanghai. She got a 3-year research thing where all she has to do is research. I said, where can I sign up for that? So she's postdoc, and like she didn't start as a cartography person, but she's sort of made her way into this place. And so she was fascinated by this map in particular, not for the things I've talked about, but something I didn't point out to everyone here, because it's not necessarily apparent, is that it's mounted as a folding screen. So it left China and went to Japan sometime in the Meiji, so late 19th century, and was mounted onto a screen, which is fantastic in terms of the fact of how cartographic information, like everything, whether it's literature, all kinds of culture, migrates from one place to another. So here's a Chinese map that's considered important in Japan and mounted in a Japanese format. And so she's fascinated by this idea of how this kind of information is conveyed and how it gets interpreted, digested, all of those things. How does it become recontextualized? So this has a very specific purpose in China at the time in 1810. However, in Japan in the 1860s, 70s, 80s, whenever this happened, maybe it was earlier than that. I don't speculate it could be that early. I give it Meiji. But I'm quite certain because of the style of the mount and the paper that was used on the back side of it that it's probably 1870s, 1880s. But the Big Blue Map is most definitely a unique map. I haven't found any other culture that did something in this bright a blue. And what's also interesting is 10 years later, 1823, they do a large format 8-scroll celestial map, the map of all of the stars, based on a 1723 star chart that was created by another one of the head of the astronomical bureaus, who happened to be a German Jesuit at the time. But the fact that we have this indigo blue map is quite fantastic. As already mentioned, the Yojigo format is unique. This is another one that we have in our collection that includes so all of the things that, in addition to the area around the capital of Seoul, and then the inner part, so this is overall, and then this interior section, it's become referred to as 13 map atlases. It becomes a kind of standard format. In this case, it's given a very interesting name, this Heijuado, this left. And there's quite a bit of debate about the view of the Korean court in relationship to the Chinese court. That if both king and emperor face south, then to the left is the Korean kingdom, and this relationship, always been a very close relationship between Korea, Korean court, and the Chinese court. So some actually interesting debate about that. And then you have, Joseon, Paldo, the eight provinces, the Dao is the character that's used traditionally for Chinese provinces as well as a Chunhado and foreign countries. And so I want to talk about this map in particular, and this brings together all kinds of, this is such a fantastic map, and this is totally uniquely Korean. We don't see a world map like this anywhere else. The construct, so I've given all of this information to you in the text here. So I showed you the world map that was used for the atlases that was based on the Ricci style map. That's one style, and it's sort of the less popular one, and it's introduced. There's some argument, and I'm willing to concede, to the 1780s, but it's in the 1880s when the West sets up its first diplomatic relations. We have attachés, we have embassies, all of those things are happening in Korea, that Ricci style map is introduced. But sometime in the late 19th century, this world map is created. And so there's a very well-known Korean scholar who calls these wheel maps. And so the other map I call world map as my, in an English alliteration. If you're interested in these, I've written a couple of articles about this. But the construct is an inner continent, an inner sea, an outer continent, and an outer sea. This is the construct from the Shanghai Jing. So this is some debate about when it was written, but 3rd century BC text that describes from China in every direction, the places, the peoples, the animals that exist in those places. So if you go 10,000 miles to the east, you come to an island, and there they have three heads and long purple hair, and they only eat crickets. Kinds of information. So there's fantastical information, mythical information that's provided, but it describes an inner continent, an inner sea, an outer continent, and an outer sea. In addition, 90% of the place names that you see on the outer continent and the inner sea are all from the Shanghai Jing. So you have a construct that includes an early Chinese text. Remember, these are atlases. This is about identity. This is about creating a unique identity. What is uniquely Korea? In addition, you have your inner continent here, the construct of the southern continent in a Buddhist construct. So you have four continents. The one that we live in and exist in is the southern continent. This is a standard Buddhist construct. We have earlier maps, Indian maps, Japanese maps, is the southern continent, which consists of a single continent with four sacred rivers that come from an axis mundi, a central mountain structure in the middle. So here's the Japanese version of that, and so this will be a little click back in a moment. But right here is this detail. So what you're looking at here is the southern continent, the 10,000 countries. And essentially, you have, here's India, Southeast Asia, Japan, China. It's a Buddhist construct. So South America's here, North America's here. We have almost all of Europe as islands represented over here. But remember, this is a Buddhist construct. So those places, although they exist and are known, have very little to do with Buddhism. But right in the middle, you have Mount Meru and the four sacred rivers, which in this construct are the Ganges and Yamuna, etc. When you look at this map, you have the Kunlun Mountains, you have the Yellow River, the Yangtze River, the Red River, and another river structure that tells you Heishui, or black water, that's no question, the Black Sea. We have the Caspian Sea represented up here. And over here, foreign water, which would probably be the Persian Gulf. But for this part of the discussion, it's the southern continent. It's a central axis, four sacred rivers that come off this main continent structure. So in addition to the Shanghai Jing, we have a Buddhist construct embedded in this map. In addition, you have this beautiful little triumvirate of the three Taoist immortal islands, Fanghu, Penglai, and someone else will come up with it, it's somewhere in my head, floating around. So you have Taoist construct. In addition, you have two sacred trees, east and west. These are associated with a Taoist construct. There are trees where the sun emerges and where the sun sets. So you have Shanghai Jing, Buddhist, Taoist. In addition, you have real place names. You have nice, prominent, with a purple ring, Joseon, Korea, China. I can't read it on this. It's all, here's Japan. I can't read it. Ryukyu is here. So your regional construct of the places, again, that you're familiar with, that you're comfortable with, again, this is about identity. So, equal status, visually, China and Korea, from a Korean perspective, of course that's the case. So you have real places that are given. You also have Annam, so you have Vietnam presented there. All of this information, Taoist, Buddhist. So you have historical, mythical, real places. And I have also added to that list We have a map from, in my book, I use a comparison with an early 18th century map. The actual contour that you see here is nearly identical to Western maps of the 18th century. And so I add, there's a third component. Western map making is also introduced into the map. All of this to make something there is no other map making tradition in the world that creates this configuration. It's also important to keep in mind that the Shanhaijing, even though it describes all of these places, was never done in a visual image in China, ever. So this is actually the first visual manifestation of a Shanhaijing construct, but in a Korean context. Something to ponder. This we talked about. And then I thought I would finish with a format, again, since we've had a Chinese format that's unique, a Korean format, and since everybody gets equal play today, I would talk about what's uniquely Japanese. All three of these that we've been talking about are the early 19th century. These are all dated to the Tempo period. So that's 1830 to 1842. All kinds of things are happening in Japan in the Tempo reign. We've got economic reforms. We've got the monetary system. We've got this three metal system, copper, gold, and silver. Everything's in flux. You've got sumptuary laws. You have ordinary people who are wearing noble dress, walking around in public. This just can't happen. There's chaos. You've got all of the major earthquakes that are happening. And so the Japanese, too, are thinking about their identity, and they're thinking about the world, and reconsidering what is uniquely us, and what is uniquely them. So the map plate, we don't have any other tradition that takes cartography and puts it on ceramic. We also happen to have, at the same time, the kilns that are producing this, the Arita kilns, the inner kilns. The whole mountain burns down, essentially, in 1828. And so the outer kilns are thinking about new designs, something that's neither Chinese, nor Rinpa, nor something earlier in Japan. And so they're looking for new ideas for decorations for large format presentation pieces like this. This is a charger, it's about this big. We have two of these blue and white Arita ware examples. They're the only known Kutani ware. So this is overglazed enamel, but it's exactly the same map if you start to look closely, and all of the provinces are listed there. And I only include this because we're very excited that we have the only known example. It's quite rare. Blue and white ones, there's quite a number that are out there. So cartographically, what's happening here? So we've seen that all of the other traditions look to the past, something from the past. So what is it that's out of the past? Did I write any of this on here? So in the 8th century, there's a very famous monk, Gyokki, and he sort of quits the church and becomes itinerant and wanders all around, primarily Kyushu and Honshu. And as he does, as he goes through each province, he creates kind of this blobby shape, this kind of amorphous shape for each province as he goes around. And we don't have the originals. There's some Kamakura copies. There's some debate about the date, but we have some 13th century examples that tell us exactly the significance of the Gyokki map. So this kind of amoeba-like blobs is a historical map-making technique that existed already in Japan for, at this point, 1,000 years. So we have that kind of construct. At the same time, because of all of the things that I've been talking about, Gyokki maps at this time are being reproduced as talismans to prevent earthquakes. This is part of the culture, the print culture that's happening at the time. We have these kind of talismans that are, you have, for example, the fish and the double fish and the carp, and you'll have, depending